Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Dorchester State Rep Carlos Enriquez held down and hit a woman who refused to have sex with him. Is 6 months in jail enough? Oscar nominations are out and some huge names are left out. Jared Bowen will fill in the blanks. And then a Harvard professor is walking across New Hampshire to honor the memory of Aaron Swartz and change American politics. He'll join us from the road to explain.
Alex Beam from the Boston Globe on Patriots fans buying marijuana legally for Sunday's pass game at Mile High Stadium. Then we'll talk gap years. If they're so great for kids between high school and starting college, how come almost no kids take them? And Kara Miller on innovation hubs popping up all over the world. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to 89.7 Boston Public Radio, WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So yesterday, a jury convicted Massachusetts State Representative Carlos Enriquez with holding down a woman and punching her after she refused to have sex with him. Cambridge District Court Judge Michelle Hogan sentenced Enriquez to 2.5 years in the House of Correction, but ordered him to serve only 6 months of the sentence in jail. Enriquez's lawyer says this was extremely unusual for a defendant with no prior criminal record. She continued to assert his innocence and ask for no jail time. So, who was right? The judge, her lawyer, or the prosecutors who asked the judge sentence the state rep to a year in jail? We'll get your answer to that question in a minute. But first, joining us on the line for her take on the case is Wendy Murphy. As you know, Wendy's a legal expert, former prosecutor. Her latest book is And Justice for Some. Wendy, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Wendy, you and I were both stunned that anybody actually is getting 6 months in jail for a first-time offense. What's your analysis of what happened to state rep, or possibly soon to be former state rep, Enriquez?
Yeah, I had the same reaction, and it's kind of hard for my brain to process, because on the one hand, I thought, well, good, finally somebody's getting a sentence that comes close to what they deserve for beating a woman. But the reason it feels strange to me is that I compare it to the wealth of other similar cases in this state where a first offender who's done something like this doesn't get any jail time at all. In fact, you know, I've bemoaned for years and talked to you many times, both of you, Jim and Marjorie, many times about how incredibly frustrating it is that the value of women's lives is not reflected in appropriately tough sentences when they're beaten by men for any reason. But if you compare what we tend to do to this case, there's something very strange about the six-month sentence here, because it's very much out of line with what happens to regular guys who do the same thing, who get so many damn bites at the apple. Many women end up dead. And, you know, I've told you guys this many times, we have a lot of domestic violence murders in this state compared to other states, relatively speaking, in part because we don't punish men who beat women. And then they keep it up and it escalates and the women disproportionately end up dead. So I'm glad that he's getting whacked. I think it's a very strange sentence considering what we do in similar cases. And it's possible, let me give the best possible deference to the judge, and she may be the kind of judge who wants to send a message about public officials who abuse their authority, and, you know, we want to make them look like they're being held to a better standard and so forth. That's not allowed. You know, you can't say because you're a state rep, I'm going to send you to jail, and all the people who are not state reps don't go to jail.
Wendy, in that case, we've talked about this one a lot. Remember, was it Gagan, who was sentenced to, what was it, 10 years in jail or something for patting a kid on the behind in a pool when obviously that was not a 10-year kind of offense.
Well,
but obviously
allegedly
he was being sentenced for what he had never been tried or convicted for. But, you know,
raping many children, we
I'm sorry, as a priest in the during that whole nightmare in the Catholic Church. You know, it's interesting. Marjorie opened this discussion by saying, Wendy, you and I, she and you were shocked that the guy even got 6 months in jail. I called Marjorie yesterday afternoon after I heard this and after I heard what I found, the incredibly offensive comments from his lawyer saying, this is after the sentence, I don't think the witness was credible at all. Enriquez continues to deny what happened. It appears that even the jury didn't believe Ms. Gonzalez on a lot of stories she told that night. He was acquitted on a couple of charges. I called Marjorie outraged, saying, I can't believe this guy only got 6 months. And she disabused me of my naivete by saying what you say. When judges are informed, and you do a lot of these things, Wendy, and you're just having a conversation or at a cocktail party, and you say, why don't these people get sentences commensurate with the severity of their conduct? What's the answer to the question?
Well, you know, there's a complicated answer and there's a simple answer. The complicated answer is rooted in history of, you know, men owning women, and our law grows from that concept that men used to own their wives, and in some ways they still have the vestiges of that reflected in these low sentences. You can't punish a guy for hitting that which he owns. And we're still moving from that position. Things are getting better, but it's been very slow. The less complicated answer is that women don't hold prosecutors and judges accountable when the low sentences are doled out. So if you can get away with giving a guy a slap on the wrist, and women don't start marching in the streets and throwing things around the way, Al Sharpton showed up in Florida and got Trayvon Martin's case elevated in terms of both public status and the potential prosecution, albeit it ended in a not guilty, but the prosecution itself may not have happened had there been no protest. Women don't express outrage when they see inadequate punishment. So politicians and prosecutors are politicians. Judges are in some ways, their sentences are a reflection of the value system, and so they don't bother sending guys off.
Yeah, but even if they're not protest, it seems to me, and I don't know this Michelle Hogan, the judge, at all, it seems to me the world changed when Jared Remy killed Jennifer Martel, because what I think the average person even knows, as much as they know the details of his alleged killing of his girlfriend and the daughter of his, the mother of his kid, was that he was released the day before in what finally a woman who I know you have a relationship with, the DA out there, is finally acknowledging after some sort of study or investigation or commission was put together, was a mistake on the part of the Middlesex County DA's office. So it seems to me that was a shot across the bow of all judges. You don't think so?
No.
Why not?
No, because it's just like the disappearance of that poor little boy, Jeremiah Oliver. There's a big flash in the news. Everybody starts wringing their hands and doing studies, and oh boy, things are going to change. And things don't change, no. And the Marion Ryan issue,
the DA,
you know,
in Middlesex.
The Middlesex DA, who I have known for a long time, and she's a good person, and I'm glad we have a woman in that position. There are no other women DAs at this point besides her. But the fact is, her proposals for reforms are meaningless. They're not going to change a thing, because, among other things, she didn't say, we really need to ramp up the prosecution efforts in all these cases and not allow women to drop the charges and so forth. Those are really the baseline problems that she didn't even suggest fixing. And when you have a criminal justice system that allows women to choose whether to drop the charges or not, you really have, I think, the wrong attitude. And so part of that is why this case is so strange to me. Enriquez beats a woman who doesn't have sex with him, and I think there are a lot of guys, or for rejecting his advances, and I think there are a lot of guys in this state saying, oh my God, he's going to jail for 6 months because he got aggressive after his wife said no to some nookie? You know, like, that's not, I mean, I know they're not husband and wife, but the feeling that you can go to jail for 6 months for getting aggressive with your girlfriend or your wife who doesn't have sex with you, that is going to resonate, and that's a good thing. The message from this case is a good thing. But the reality is there will be no similar punishment of any guy like this unless there's some political backstory that justifies why this guy got whacked. And I bet that's really the thing that matters most. And so the system doesn't change when you gratuitously overpunish a politician because whatever bad thing he did that made people in power crazy, and I don't even know if that's the true story, but if this guy's getting whacked because of politics and everybody's coming out of the woodwork saying, you got to resign, and the real story is they don't like him for some deal he did or didn't do on Beacon Hill, then rest assured, the rape and the beating of the next woman that's even worse than this is still going to lead to that discounted punishment, probation, slap on the wrist, go home, you know, go home and try to get along with each other. That's what we're going to see, and that's what's so sad about this story.
Wendy Murphy, thank you as always.
Thanks,
for
Wendy.
Taking the time for being with us. You are so passionate on these issues, and we love to talk to you.
You're welcome, guys. Take care.
Talk Thanks. To you. So there are three points of view, as I mentioned before, Wendy called in, on display in the courtroom yesterday. There was the lawyer for Enriquez who said he should do no jail time. He's a first offender, and the jury didn't believe some of the allegations, which is true, even though they obviously believed others. He's convicted on two counts of assault and battery. There was my position and also the prosecutor's that he should do at least a year. And there was the judge, who obviously is the final decision maker, which is 6 months. As you just heard, Marjorie and Wendy, who have been involved in fighting for women's rights for both of their careers, are celebrating the fact that this Michelle Hogan, this judge in Cambridge District Court, gave him something in jail, 6 months. I'm not. I have to say, it may be out of the norm, and it may be a higher sentence than is the norm in these kinds of cases. But the fact, first-time offender or not, that you can do this to a woman and only do 6 months behind bars is staggering to me. It's almost an incentive. Listen, do whatever you want, because the likelihood is you're not going to go to jail, and if you do, you're just going to spend a few months there. The number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What's your take on the sentence that State Representative Carlos Enriquez, and as Marjorie said, he is likely to be soon former state rep, as a chorus of people from Dorchester State Rep, well, former state rep Marty Walsh, the governor, and Bob DeLeo, the Speaker of the House, have all said he should step down.
Well, Wendy Murphy, who has been very, very involved in domestic violence issues, has made a great point. She made it during the whole Jared Remy situation. It's a big fight between domestic violence views. I mean, some groups think, and a lot of the battered women's groups think, that if a woman, like in the Jared Remy case, doesn't want to prosecute, then we shouldn't prosecute. We just heard Wendy say that's ridiculous. They should be prosecuted all the
Wendy.
Time. And I agree with Wendy too, but that was one of the issues why Jared Remy got out and then allegedly went back and stabbed his girlfriend to death, who's the mother of his child. But, you know, it's really sad what's happened in some ways to domestic violence cases, because what you have is people holding the victim to an extremely high standard, the so-called righteous victim who did everything right, who wasn't drinking, who wasn't doing drugs, who was perfect on the stand. That's very hard to find. And you also have, on the other side, you have a lot of people becoming skeptical of domestic violence cases because, and shame on defense attorney or divorce lawyers who do this, you have women being advised to make up these phony claims of domestic violence when there are custody battles between them and their ex-husbands during a divorce. So the whole thing is very, very complicated. But the bottom line is, if more people did these kind of jail time, it would be a wonderful thing because they'd have some time to think about it.
And there'd probably be less of this kind
of
violence. Of
course there would. You want to risk going to jail again for 6 months? No, you don't. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What was your reaction to the Enriquez sentencing? Did you think it was great? Were you stunned that actually someone went to jail in the first offense? I certainly was. We'll ask you guys what you think.
And also, I said it before to Wendy. I want to say it again. I don't know this lawyer at all. Her name is Soriana Mills. I don't think – this is after the jury came back and convicted this state rep on two charges. I don't think the witness was credible at all. Enriquez continues to deny what happened. It appears that even the jury didn't believe Ms. Gonzalez. There's been a lot of stories she told that night. Well, that is technically true, and they did believe her and others. Not only did he not take the stand, which he is perfectly constitutionally entitled to not do, he also didn't take the opportunity the judge gave him to make a statement after the conviction and pre-sentencing. And maybe a judge can't hold that against him. I can hold it against him.
Well, I think a jury does. I mean, you say to yourself, if you're
well,
innocent,
even though they're not prohibited from doing it.
Well, they're not supposed to do a lot of things they end up doing in court cases. I mean, if someone is wrongly accused of a crime and didn't do it, don't you think the first thing you want to do is get in the stand and defend yourself and say, I did not do this? Didn't work that well for, like, Pamela Smart. She got up on the stand up in New Hampshire when she was accused of killing her husband. She went to jail anyway.
Well, stay with Sal DeMacy, by the way. I think one of the things that offended a lot of people, including me, is Sal DeMacy did not take the stand and then proceeded as soon as he was convicted. This is the former Speaker of the House, who, by the way, is in jail longer than he should be, even though he should have gone to jail. It's a whole other topic. Then he takes to the steps of the Moakley Courthouse and presents his defense. Well, if you have a defense and I know all my criminal defense lawyer friends are going to be upset about this, then have the courage to present it. And we're talking to you too, Whitey Bulger. 877-301-8970. Let's start with Ryan. You're in Newton, New Hampshire. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
Good, yeah. I'm just speaking in terms of just general rape and assault cases against women. To treat rape and assault as anything but rape and assault, which is to give it any kind of mask or anything that treats it as if it's less than acceptable, you really have to look at it in a much harder light and realize that this is an assault on a human being, and it should be treated as much harsher than it is.
I agree. I agree. And when you hear people like Marjorie and Wendy, who know what they're talking about, trust me, Ryan, saying this is actually a good thing because the guy got 6 months, where in most cases, if it was his first offense, which it was in this case, he'd get nothing. What's your reaction to that?
Well, again, I'm just speaking in general. Like, I understand that this may be kind of a small victory, but still, in general, a lot of people still look at women as lying about rape and lying about assault for attention, and it's sexist and it's wrong.
Well, there was just a terrible case. I think it was in Montana where the judge gave the rapist convicted 30 days because he said he was a teacher, by the way, and she was the student. And he said that she was 13 or 14, but looked much older than her age. And he got 30 days. It became a big stink out there. But, you know, very few rape cases that are brought to trial ever get convictions. I mean, very, very few. And what often happens is the defendant will plead down to a lesser charge.
And what would have happened? You said me upstairs, had he pled prior, said I want to try, what would have happened?
My guess is he would have been sentenced to domestic violence treatment, and he would not have done any time in
Ryan,
jail.
Ryan, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Allison in Warwick, Rhode Island. Hi, Allison.
Hello, Allison.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Great.
So I just wanted to give a perspective from Colorado. I'm an approved domestic violence offender treatment provider there, but I live now in Rhode Island. And in the state of Colorado, a couple of things would have been similar and different. First of all, yes, he probably would not have been convicted of jail time punishment. He would have been convicted of assault with a domestic violence enhancer, which would have probably resulted in a deferred sentence provided he did his counseling requirements, 36 weeks of court-ordered domestic violence offender treatment. But the other thing that happens in Colorado, which I'm surprised to hear doesn't happen in Massachusetts, is the district attorney would have prosecuted the case regardless of what the victim wanted. Automatic prosecution happens in the state of Colorado.
Well, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, I think it is. We also, however, get the end result of the plea bargain of, and we'll defer your sentence, your jail time, if you agree to treatment, which, of course, is a good thing. But I do think it is sort of a deal that is made in the justice system that sometimes helps women and sometimes does not.
Allison, what's wrong with sentencing someone to prison and as part of their sentence saying, and when you get out, you got to go to this treatment program for X number of months? Why does that have to be one or the other? Why can't it be both?
Right. I believe that it should be both. And maybe if he's in jail, he could do some treatment while he's in there. Why not?
Amen. Well, you know, Allison, you also raise a point. I'm glad you talked about what the laws in Colorado, or at least the practices. The thing, and I know this is not an original thought, so my apologies in advance, but it is so obvious that if there was ever a case where you proceed, even if the complaining witness doesn't want to go ahead, it's this kind of case, because obviously the reason in most cases she doesn't want to go ahead, like Jennifer Martell and the Jared Remy case that you may or may not know about, is because they're scared to death of the person that they're about to testify against. So it is totally ass backwards, and I wish that was the practice here. Allison, thanks for the call.
Well, what the other side would argue, the side that does not want the defendant to be prosecuted without permission of the person that's attacked, is that she's dependent on this guy for his money. Where's she going to live? She's not going to be able to survive. She's got kids. I mean, that's what they're – it's really kind of sick when you think about it. The idea is, well, I'm going to put up with an occasional beating so I can feed my kids and have a place
to
live.
I know. That's exactly what it is, isn't
that's,
it?
Well, yeah. Well, that's what they're arguing. Sherry from Marblehead. What do you think, Sherry?
Well, I'm glad to hear some other folks are calling in from other spots. I moved here from Ohio, mm-hmm. and I went through this personally with my daughter, who's now 27, 2 years ago. And what's shocking to me is in the state of Ohio, she was not married to this person, but she was living with this person. In the state of Ohio, if you're living with the person who beat you up, it's a third-degree misdemeanor. If that person was not someone you shared a dwelling with, it's a felony, which is just, it was just so appalling. But the prosecution, we took it through to the courts. The state prosecutor interviewed her. The judge, whenever they were determining whether or not to prosecute, because they don't prosecute if the witness isn't going to press charges. The judge, whenever she stood in front of, and at the time she's 25 years old, I took her the day after it happened. So all of the bruises were showing up then. That judge, a female judge, said to my daughter, "Is that makeup you have all over your eyes?"
And what happened to that judge?
Well, now that judge was just the one who determined. They did end up prosecuting, but they pushed. It was almost a year of back and forth and back and forth and postponements. And they kept telling us, "This is so amazing that you continue through most of the women, 80% of the cases."
Oh, Sherry, your phone is breaking up, unfortunately. Thank you for sharing that story with us. Is that makeup you're wearing? I mean, are you kidding? It's well, you know, you say to yourself that couldn't happen in 2013 or 2014, but what that judge who just stepped down from the bench with that assault sentence against, what was it, a teacher or wherever it was in the far west?
Oh, Montana.
Montana. I mean,
yeah.
Obviously that still happens
in the real
world. The
teacher was 54 years old. The girl was 14 years old, and the guy got to 30 days.
The Jared Remy thing, I don't know if Wendy misunderstood my question or didn't articulate it well. I wasn't suggesting that whatever formal changes that Marion Ryan, who's now the Middlesex DA, was going to implement as a result of this, whatever they did, investigation or whatever it was going to change things. I was talking about the fear on the part of judges was going to change things. Is you don't want to be a judge. I don't even know what the judge's name was in that Jared Remy release. It's surprising. It's not a name we've heard. Don't you think that gives them religion, that you could be the one who ends up having a Jared Remy on your hands?
Well, you know, there was a famous case right in Somerville in the 80s, a young woman named Pamela Dunn. I believe she was 22. She goes into court before this Judge Heffernan and says she's afraid of her husband.
Oh,
and
this is a famous
Judge
case,
Heffernan
yeah.
lectures her about how she's taking up the taxpayers' dollars with these ridiculous allegations, and she should go home and make up with her husband. And then Pamela Dunn is shortly thereafter murdered, and it became a big brouhaha. So,
what happened to Heffernan, the judge?
He had to recuse himself hereafter from any domestic violence cases. I think he did stay on the bench. Obviously, the guy felt horrible, but that's another whole issue. I mean, there are a lot of judges judging things who knew nothing about the subject matter they're involved in the probate court and domestic.
What do you need to know not to make that kind of comment? I mean, what level of knowledge, judicial knowledge or substantive knowledge, you need to know about the world not to make that kind of comment?
I think history would tell us that some judges are bad judges and they're hostile toward women making these kinds of allegations. And maybe because they've got something going on in their own life. I don't know. But you don't have to look very far to – I mean, look at this judge out in Montana. How can you say that someone's 53 and this woman is charging a statutory rape or a rape with a 14-year-old girl – 30 days. No big deal. She looked older than 14. How is he supposed to know?
Let's squeeze another one in. Jay, you're on the road somewhere. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy
and
Mark
Regan.
I'm sorry.
Yes. I didn't mention a very crucial fact in
that
case. That the 14-year-old girl killed herself.
Of course. Jay, you're next. Hi.
Good. How are you doing?
Great.
I just wanted to preface by saying that I think wife beaters and child molesters are the lowest of the low on the totem pole. But to me, it seems like this guy got off light. Usually, I grew up you go to trial and you get guilty, you get smoked, you get the max. And it seems to me, losing a trial, he did all right, you know.
Well, especially since, as we should have said this, I don't know if you said it when Wendy was on, the judge in her sentencing said that he showed no remorse. Not only did the lawyer continue to profess the innocence of her client, but you're convicted, you show no remorse, and you get 6 months in jail. Jay, thanks for the call.
That is a great point, because he forced the state to go through a trial. They really don't like to do that. They want to plead down
and
move the cases faster. What's your
position? That 6 months is more than would ordinarily be gotten in a case like this, but it shouldn't be. I mean,
it should not be. Obviously, these guys should get much tougher sentences, and they obviously should in rape cases as well, but they don't.
I think I've had Carlos Enriquez on my television show. I'm not sure, so I've met him, but I don't know anything about him. Do you think the next Carlos Enriquez would think twice if he knew that this Carlos Enriquez, I mean the generic Carlos Enriquez, ended up doing a year in jail? I do.
I don't actually think they think about it beforehand, but I think that while they're in jail, they're thinking when they get out of jail, they don't want to come back. So I'm not sure, because a lot of these things happen in the moment. It would have that, what do you call that, what do you call the thing about death penalty, the effect it's supposed to have?
Deterrent, we call it.
Thank
yes.
you very much. I couldn't think of the word. I don't know that it would have a deterrent effect before, but certainly after.
Let's do one more quick one. Joanne, you're in Cambridge. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for your call. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to distinguish between the kind of restraining order that is issued in the context of a divorce case. I do a lot of family law, so I've practiced divorce. Those restraining orders under 209A are often used strategically in divorce litigation. That's completely different from the kind of assault and battery that you have here. This is a crime, and it's a penal code issue. So assault and battery is a crime against the state, which is a much stronger argument than anything else for not requiring that the victim go forward. Now, in all crimes, you need the victim to be a witness, and there are victim witness advocates in all the courts to
Excuse me for a second. That's not true. In many places, including New York State, they go ahead with domestic violence cases without the witness. They use 911 tapes. They use recordings. They use pictures.
We just heard about Colorado.
They use pictures of her. So they do go ahead without the victim as a witness.
I'm not disputing that. All I'm talking about is Massachusetts and distinguishing conceptually between the 209A restraining order, where the district attorney is not involved, and the case that you're talking about, where the district attorney is involved, and where this is a crime against the state, it is an even stronger reason for going forward without needing the victim. That is, I'm agreeing with you. But to conflate the kind of restraining order that is used in a divorce case with the far more serious thing that we're talking about here... Just want to point out that they're analytically distinct.
Joanne, hold on for 1 second, because there are cases, and I'm sure you're aware of them, where people are falsely making accusations. It's very small.
Joanne's not denying that. She's talking about a criminal prosecution as opposed to a restraining order that is sought as part of a strategy in a divorce case, which is what you mentioned before.
Assault and battery claims against their husbands falsely in divorce cases. I'm sure there's very small numbers of them, but it has happened. Right?
I'm not disputing that.
Okay.
I'm not disputing that. All I'm saying is that the far more frequent strategic use
is a 209A.
Is a 209A restraining order.
Okay.
We got it. Joanne, thank you kindly for your call. We appreciate it.
And we are moving on now to a much more cheerful subject. We're talking with arts reporter Jared Bowen about the Oscar nominations, which happened this morning. And not just the nominations, but who got snubbed. Who got one too many nods this year or not enough is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Higher education impacts everything from our economy to our ability to remain a world leader.
Governor Patrick stood shoulder to shoulder with students and said the Commonwealth ought to play a bigger role in making college more affordable.
This is about them today, yes, but it's also about all of us tomorrow.
On Campus, the WGBH News Higher Ed Desk with reporter Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
And the Museum of Science, where you can bring your intellectual appetite to our global kitchen. You'll learn that the food you eat connects you to people and places you've never known. Now on exhibit. More at mos.org/globalkitchen.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. As Marjorie said, this is a bit of a change of pace. Today, entertainment titans Tom Hanks, Robert Redford, Oprah Winfrey got the big snub from the Oscars, but they weren't left out of the nominations to make room for lesser knowns, up-and-comers, those kind of people in the film world. Instead, they were squeezed out by some of Hollywood's other giants, people like Meryl Streep 18 times. She's been nominated, Martin Scorsese, etc. Joining us for his take on this year's nominees is GBH's arts editor, Jared Bowen, also the host of the TV show Open Studio. Hey there, Jared.
Hi. Nice to be with you guys.
So, Jared, who was the biggest snubby?
I think in terms of performance, by just looking at it, I mean, first of all, we have to back up for a second and say all of this is so much about campaigning now. It really is like a political campaign. It's about how much money you put into advertising, how much you get your candidate out there to shake hands and show up to events and do press and blah, blah, blah. But if you're to really look at the performances, I think that it was Tom Hanks was so good in Captain Phillips, and to not see him nominated is really, really, really surprising.
So maybe you think Tom Hanks, because he's been around for a while, and Robert Redford, who's an older guy now, maybe they just had enough with this campaign and they weren't going to bother with
it. What is Meryl Streep?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, does she campaign like that? I thought maybe that Hanks and Redford just didn't want to campaign.
No, I think that – well, I think that Robert Redford definitely did not, and some people are saying that's part of the reason why he didn't get a nomination. Also, the movie was so small, and I think a lot of the population was turned off when they realized it was just him in a boat for a couple of hours, and
yeah,
they didn't really see it. It didn't do very well at the box office, and
did
frankly,
you see it?
That also translates. No, it's the one major movie that I thought was going to be nominated that I didn't see.
I haven't seen it either.
So I can't really speak to it. The other one that it sort of made me sad was Emma Thompson in Saving Mr. Banks. She was so good in that film. I'm not sure why they left her out either. But Meryl Streep was great in August, Osage County, so that was certainly deserved.
But we just stay on the Robert Redford thing. See, my naive assumption, I understand the campaign deal. My assumption was the guy is, what is he, his late 70s.
Late 70s, yeah.
Was he, did I read this morning, last time he was nominated was for The Sting, what, 40 years ago or something like that.
Oh, that
so
was a great movie.
Don't you, my notion was, despite the fact there are the other ones who were nominated for Best Actor were Christian Bale, obviously American Hustle, Bruce Dern, DiCaprio. How do you pronounce the 12 Years a Slave? How do you pronounce the...
Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Thank you very much. And Matthew McConaughey for Dallas Buyers Club. As great as all that may be, the feeling was Robert Redford gets a nomination, and at the end of his career, he wins an Academy Award. Isn't that what was supposed to happen?
No, because we have two of those this year, because Bruce Dern is the other one.
Oh, right.
Here's this iconic actor in all these great, great roles who we haven't seen in forever, and then he comes out in Nebraska and is so fantastic in a really, really well-made film. It's just a great story about him. So I think he sort of took all that conversation and all that press and eclipsed Robert Redford because it really became about Bruce Dern, who is truly terrific in Nebraska. I don't know if you guys saw that. I don't know how many of the nominations you've seen.
Well, I've seen a few. I don't believe
it's not necessary, Marjorie.
That Jim has seen any, actually.
You've seen
no, actually, let me explain something to you, Jared, since you brought it up. Thank you for bringing it up. My position is I don't want to go to the Oscars, watch them on March 2nd with any bias.
Okay.
So my view is, no, actually, I did see one movie this year. It's on the list. I saw 20 Feet from Stardom, which is nominated for Best Documentary. That's about the backup singers, one of the great documentaries I've ever seen.
A lovely shout out via email from Gina, who says, after your frenetic promotion of 20 Feet from Stardom, she went to see it, and she was very glad she did.
Well thank you, Gina. You're a wise woman.
I'll help you then. Dallas Buyers Club is a romantic comedy with Sarah Jessica Parker, spending spree. You know, The Wolf of Wall Street is about the Iditarod. It's a nice Disney cartoon.
Let's go down the best pictures and tell us what didn't make it. We're going to focus on what didn't make it. We're going to show some empathy today. America, Hustle, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyers Club, Gravity, Her, Nebraska, Philomena, 12 Years a Slave, and The Wolf of Wall Street. No huge surprises. The Butler is not in there. And
Oprah.
Llewyn Davis
Oprah.
Is not. Well, let's stay with best movies before we get to actors and actresses. Were you surprised by either of those decisions?
I wasn't. Inside Llewyn Davis is a fine film. It's
Coen
a good
Brothers,
film.
Right?
It's the Coen Brothers. I enjoyed it, but I didn't walk away from it really thinking about it. And The Butler, I didn't think it was a terrifically made film. I only saw it recently, and I really couldn't understand what all the buzz was about.
Yeah, but in terms of politics, wait a second. This Martin Luther King's, it's the 50th anniversary on the March on Washington. His birthday, he would have been 85, I think, yesterday, the day before. That's not part part of the we are all led to believe that this is some liberal cabal in Hollywood that does the piece. Well, what is more PC?
12 years a slave. I think that's the
only entitled to have one film about African Americans.
That might be the thinking of some
people.
I
agree with Marjorie. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Hollywood is thinking that way. But also, the other thing you have to remember, this is a factor too. The Butler came out this summer, which is a distant memory. Most of the Oscar nominations, and if I look at this list, everything that I'm looking at really came out just within the last couple of months, and that's what always happens. So unless you're really recent in voters' minds, you're not going to get the nomination.
Well, you know what we're going to do, because we are empathetic, as I said, we're going to play, here's a little scene from Lee Daniels' The Butler, because you will not hear it on March 2nd.
James told me that Dr. King told the president that we would be going to the streets down south for our right to vote. Didn't you, baby?
Is that what you heard?
That Dr. King ain't no joke. This little militant ass.
She talking to me.
Well, you know them three kids got killed down there trying to get colored folks registered to vote.
That's why I didn't want Lewis to go down there. That's what I was trying to tell you.
Well, you shouldn't have sent him down there.
I know.
Well, he is down there now, and there ain't nothing we can do about it. The only reason the president's and the FBI is because two of them were white.
Now, who told you that?
Yeah, who told her that?
Where you hear that? I didn't tell you that.
It was in one of them colored newspapers from Baltimore.
See, she's getting smart now. Damn.
Wasn't good enough to make the cut.
No, and frankly, along that vein, I probably shouldn't say this because this will end my career right here.
Go ahead.
Because she's listening. But Oprah, I didn't think was that fantastic. I know. I will never have another show. I will never go anywhere because Oprah controls everything. I love her, but I didn't think she was that great in this film, especially when you look at some of the other Best Supporting Actor.
Well, let's get to them in a second. But you were talking about campaigning before. Isn't Oprah like a de facto constant campaign for everything? I'm serious. How do they resist Oprah Winfrey as a Best Supporting Actress kind of person?
It did surprise me, and she is friends with probably all of the voting academy. So no, I can't tell you why it didn't happen. It doesn't completely make sense. But unless you are going on merit, in which case maybe they looked at it and she doesn't necessarily measure up to some of the other great performances.
Well, speaking of great performances, may I move to a great performance,
sure.
Jim? Because we're not supposed to talk about movies yet. Cate Blanchett in Blue Jasmine. I thought that was a great performance.
Wasn't she ravishing? And that's the exception, because that came out this summer.
Yeah.
And that was one that came out, and there was immediate buzz about her, and she became the one to beat. And I think there is a great conversation about the actors, because you have Sandra Bullock in Gravity, who's fantastic. Meryl Streep in August Osage County is great. But I agree with you. I think that Cate Blanchett is just so ravishing and mesmerizing from beginning to end in that film.
And it's so totally believable. Her sort of a breakdown, and she plays a very unlikable character. You have some sympathy for her, but she's not, you know, you don't like her, and that's hard to pull off.
Yeah, she, of course, you know, just to reacquaint people, she plays a woman of a Bernie Madoff-like guy who is still trudging around in her Chanel suits but having to work in a dentist's office, and we're supposed to feel sorry for her.
Right,
but
she's complaining about her fall from zillions of dollars. Right.
And what she does is she constructs this aura that you as the audience fall into it. You fall into her own delusions of what her life should be and how she's taking advantage of her poor little sister who's putting her up in her one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco.
And the little sister's great.
Yeah.
It's a really good movie.
When you were listing the Best Actress nominees, you didn't mention Amy Adams from American Hustle. You didn't mention Judi Dench from Philomena. Is the reason you didn't mention Adams, American Hustle, Best Movie, Best Actor, Christian Bale, Best Actress, what do they have, 10 nominations or something? Are you one of the people who think it's a fun movie but doesn't deserve this kind of recognition?
Nope, not at all. Actually, I saw it when I came out of American Hustle thinking that was the best film I'd seen all year.
Really?
Absolutely. And there hadn't been a lot of buzz going into it. So, like you, Jim, I was able to be pure. I was able to go into this without any bias.
Well, you know what's amazing to me, and it has to be because it's Martin Scorsese and because Leonardo DiCaprio is starring in it, The Wolf of Wall Street. I mean, okay, after you see the 27th gorgeous-looking blonde with somebody snorting cocaine off her body, you kind of think, enough already. I mean, they repeat. I get it. It's 3 hours long. If they had done it in 2 hours, maybe it would have been. But it just goes on and on and on. I can't believe it's one of the best movies of the year. It was so overdone.
And I think that was one of the surprises, that he knocked out Spike Jones for directing for her. And that's, people really figure out that's how he got his slot for Wolf of Wall Street. I think it's a really good film. And I can't understand this controversy, because you can't leave that theater without looking at all that excess and wanting to either vomit or take a shower because you just want to be out of that space completely. But I don't think it was an exceptionally made film. I'm not sure he should have been nominated. But I do think that Leonardo DiCaprio was terrific.
He was.
And
he was terrific.
I mean, the stuff that Martin Scorsese made him, maybe that's why he was nominated, because he made Leonardo DiCaprio roll around on the ground for 3 hours during the film. I mean, it was just so comedic, the stuff that he got Leonardo DiCaprio to do.
When he's so stoned, he took like too many Quaaludes or something like that, and he's crawling out the front door of this very swish, waspy country club to try to get back to his car. That is a great
and
scene.
And rolling down the steps. I mean, yeah. Here's one of our big matinee idols, and you're rolling him on the ground.
So you mentioned her a minute ago, and was anybody thinking, see, I operate in a totally different plane because I don't know what I'm talking about, as opposed to you, Jared. My assumption was the Academy saying, what can we do to get people talking about these things? And what I would have done is I would have nominated, even though I haven't seen that yet either, Scarlett Johansson, because you never see her. She's the operating system, which Joaquin Phoenix falls in love with.
You'd love this movie.
In her. Are you serious
yes,
or no?
Yes, you would.
Well, I will. I'm going to see everything eventually.
I can see you and your computer getting involved.
Maybe yeah. Maybe I have. Maybe I will.
Maybe I'm standing too close to Jim and his computer.
How
right
was
now.
She? How was Scarlett? You know, she didn't deserve a nomination, did she?
She did. She was great.
I wouldn't have a problem with it at all if she did, because she holds half of this movie just with her voice alone.
It's wonderful.
It's just like I feel like Sandra Bullock is completely deserving because you're watching her face up in these really tight shots for half of the movie. And just her face should get her nominated because it's like a masterclass in acting. Just Scarlett Johansson's voice is totally worthy. And she could have been nominated for this. She couldn't have been nominated for the Golden Globe. So this, I think it would have been a nice precedent.
Why couldn't she have been nominated for the Golden Globes? You have to physically be in the film?
I guess so.
Is that true?
It's in their rules, yeah.
That's odd. Is it not?
You know one of the funniest things about her is
who?
They have this
Scarlett Johansson?
The movie takes place in the future, and the guys are all wearing these really high-waisted pants.
I know. I just saw that piece on it. Apparently, that's where we're going. I have to throw out all my pants. But they don't really tell you when in the future. It's just coming. Although,
so
isn't it completely plausible? It's completely plausible that you could have this operating system that knows everything that would appeal to you and you can swoon for it. That's why it was somewhat disturbing, actually, I thought, because it's so plausible.
It's totally plausible, and there's not a lot of hassle. You know, your operating system's not going to give you a hard time. You're not going to get to fight about money or sex or any of these things. I mean, and the beautiful voice.
Although there was a fight about sex, remember that?
That's right. There was a fight about
sex. By the way, if you were unavailable today, Jar, we're going to have a computer do the segment
nice.
With us, but it was good.
Speaking of which, I heard you were going to give Peter Kadzis my job yesterday.
He was doing television criticism with his exultation about girls. We're talking to Jared Bowen, arts editor. As you know, the 86th annual Academy Award nominations came out this morning. Before we get back to the movies, is Doogie Howser, who's the MC of this
thing? It's Ellen DeGeneres this year.
Oh, it is?
Yep, and she's going to completely change it up. If you remember last year, it was Seth MacFarlane, who I think took it into the toilet.
So I love him, but I thought he was horrible.
No, and that whole number about boobs, you know, they showed their boobs, all the actresses, I thought it was just revolting. Ellen DeGeneres has said she wants it to be a much classier show this year, and she's so funny, and I think she, like Oprah, knows half the room, and I think that's part of the problem is you get up on that stage and it's so tense because it's such an intense night and nobody really wants to laugh because they're too nervous, but she does know a lot of these people, so I think they'll feel comfortable with her and we might see a different energy.
What about Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, who did such a great job in the Golden Globes? Would they not be considered Oscar-type hostesses?
No, I think that anything goes because there have been multiple hosts in
the
past.
Because they're
so
great.
I think they'd be good too. Although I was slightly disappointed in them
this year.
I didn't laugh as much as I had the first year.
I thought it was fabulous.
Although the one joke about George Clooney drifting off instead of dating somebody his own age or being in a room with somebody his own age was one of the best jokes I've ever heard.
The joke about welcoming Leonardo DiCaprio. Remember that one?
You do that, Marjorie, unfortunately, you have to tell the joke.
Well, go ahead. You tell it.
No, I will choose not to do it. It was I guess we can. Can we say this on the air? We're looking to our colleagues
it's
here.
The V word.
As welcoming as a young we're going to give the same kind of welcome to Leonardo DiCaprio as what?
They said, I think. Like a supermodel's vagina.
Vagina, that's exactly what
it
said.
Let's all give a warm welcome
that's exactly
to Leonardo
what it was.
DiCaprio.
Oh, okay, let's start at the top and go down here, even though we're going to see you, I'm sure, again before March 2nd. What is the best picture? They now, as of the last few years, I hate this, by the way, they have 10 nominations, I assume, so they can capture more of an audience and that sort of thing. I liked 5. It was narrower. It was more more, you know, yeah, the real tops. Too. But now the 10, what's the best movie? Not what's going, I don't care what's going to win. We'll do that before when we see it before March 2nd. What's the best movie in that group?
I think it's American Hustle.
You do?
Yep.
Really?
Yep. I think it was the tightest film, best acting, well-crafted from beginning to end. I do think it was the best.
And how about a best actor? We mentioned who those people are. Who's the class of that field?
The best actor, that's a tough one. I mean, Chiwetel Ejiofor is just so fantastic in 12 Years a Slave. But I also really, really liked Bruce Dern. And you know, and it's funny, even though I just talked about American Hustle, I Christian Bale wasn't my favorite. I think it's either Chiwetel Ejiofor or Bruce Dern.
And how about actress?
Actress, that's a tough one. See, this is why I love the Oscars this year, because I think
a lot of them are good.
I mean, I have such a soft spot for Meryl Streep, because she masticates the scenery and everything that she's in.
She's
and
great.
You just get out of her way because she's going to do it anyway. But you know what? It may be Cate Blanchett, although I just, like I said, I loved watching Sandra Bullock from beginning
to end
in Gravity. And she held that movie entirely by herself after George Clooney left her.
Now, let me say, even though I've not seen Gravity, I think the reason I can participate in this part of the conversation is because I really do want to see it. I really want to see that badly as I did when I saw the trailers. I thought Sandra Bullock, I think she's one of the most overrated actresses I have ever seen.
Overrated? You know, actually, now
she won. She won for, what was that thing called, Blindside or whatever?
Yeah.
That was one of the most pedestrian performances.
And I agree with
ever,
you. You're
ever.
Right. You're right.
And so, but this is, everybody's saying what you're saying, that she's spectacular.
Yeah, this is completely different. And this is the other thing. It's so political. Tom Hanks won for the Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I started to say the Philadelphia Story. No, he was not with Katharine
One of
Hepburn.
My favorite movies, by the way, the Philadelphia Story. I love it.
But he won for that because it was about AIDS. It was a subject matter when really he should have won, as he did the next year, for Forrest Gump, because it was a better role. So sometimes you just win because, you know, and I think maybe it was just her time. People were happy for her that she'd been in all these romantic comedies and finally she broke out, and that's why she won for The Blind Side. But I agree with you. This, though, she should win for.
You know, speaking of AIDS, Philomena is the story of a woman who had to give up her child when she was pregnant as a teenager. And there was a great story, if people haven't seen it, in the New York Times, about the actual son, because it was a true story.
Yeah.
His search for his mother, and you can just Google Philomena and the son who died of AIDS, and it's a great poignant tale.
Did you watch the piece of the Golden Globes where the real Philomena actually went to the stage with the star? It was actually quite great.
No.
I don't remember what award they presented, but it was quite
a
beautiful
moment. But
there's
a great picture of the real Philomena at the graveside of her son, who requested to be born, I mean, not born, to be buried in Ireland. So it's a great story.
So yeah. What have we not asked? What have we not talked about that it's a real standout from this year? Because one of the things people do, and I am amongst them, by the way, I was I guess 90% not joking before. I haven't seen many of the films at all, but I usually do in a rush sort of binge viewing prior to the actual awards. What here is huge that people are not talking enough about? Whether it's an actor, a director, a movie, what falls into that category?
I think the other really great story this year is June Squibb from Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And she's a woman in her mid-80s and has been an actress her whole life, been a performer. And actually, the CBS Sunday Morning did a great profile of her this past Sunday. And finally, in her mid-80s, she's hitting this major blitz. And she is so good in Nebraska as the really caustic, sardonic wife of Bruce Dern, who's just – they've been married forever. She's had it up to here with him, especially now that he wants to go on this quest to go pick up the sweepstakes lottery winnings in Nebraska that don't actually exist. And then they stop in the hometown where he grew up along the way, and then seeing her interact with his family and sort of taking control. And just every line that comes out of her mouth, you just roll over laughing. In fact, I need to see it again because I know I missed great ones.
And she's nominated for Best Supporting Actress.
Yeah, which is fantastic. She lost at the Globes, unfortunately, but it... She's a great story, and she is deserving, too.
How does a movie like that do? I mean, I had heard very little about it, and then obviously Bruce – well, not obviously if you didn't see it. Bruce Dern's daughter, obviously a great actress, I think, in her own right. We talked about her father the other night at the Golden Globes. But it doesn't get huge buzz. It's not the demographic that you'd think do they make any money, those kinds of movies, or are they just little small – they're small things that just get by?
Well, that is one of the problems this year. I don't think that probably did make a lot of money because so much of Hollywood now counts on what they're going to make overseas, and how do you sell a movie, a little black and white movie with some –
Is it a black and white movie?
It's a black and white movie.
Oh, that's great.
It looks very bleak. Looks very bleak.
It does. In fact, it was so jarring when I saw the CBS Sunday Morning piece and I saw they were showing clips of the shooting and it was all in color. It was very jarring because that's not the film you know. But it's how do you sell a movie like that overseas? And that's the problem this year. The only one that's done really well so far is Gravity. The rest of them haven't done very well at the box office.
Is that so?
Yeah.
American Hustle is not a hero?
No, not yet. Not
and The Wolf of Wall Street neither.
No, no.
How about, you know what else that got such huge buzz? As a matter of fact, Reverend Eugene Rivers, who comes in and talks to us from time to time, was raving about this film, Fruitvale Station. That it's a very terrible story based on a young man being killed in this Oakland cop situation. It looks like the cops overreacted from what I've read about it. But that was hailed by everybody and got nowhere either.
It was. In fact, it's sitting on my coffee table right now. I just came from Netflix because it was the last one that I really, aside from All Is Lost, that I hadn't seen that I was sure was going to be nominated.
Do you watch them on your TV or your computer?
When I'm at home, I watch everything on my television.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm so spoiled in having to go to the theater so much that it really does impact me when I see something on a smaller screen.
Me too.
It changes the dynamic.
It does.
I feel like it's necessary to see a film with an audience because it really changes the dynamic and sensibility and the whole feeling of it when you see it, you know, by yourself or maybe one or two other people.
And I assume they don't anymore because so many movies people see, obviously, either from on television or on a computer screen. I'm assuming until the advent of those other forums to show movies that directors were conscious of when they're putting a movie together that it was going to be seen by a group of people together. Was that not part of the mindset?
Oh, of course. And now you talk to any director and they talk about having to reconcile the fact that their movie will probably be seen on an iPad or even worse, on an iPhone. It's terrible. Although I will say I did watch Blue Jasmine only recently. Going back to my rule about Woody Allen ever since he married his daughter wife, that I refused...
His daughter wife?
That I refused to pay for any of his movies. So it was on the plane, so I got to see it for free. But I watched it on, you know, those little tiny airplane screens. And that's how great Cate Blanchett was, is that she managed to transcend my little airplane screen.
Well, I don't want to say anything. I actually am a Woody Allen fan, despite his horrible behavior. But he does make, and I don't, literally and figuratively, make small movies that I've always found, even fabulous, like The Manhattans and The Annie Halls, they actually translate pretty well, I thought.
On the small screen.
It's a small screen.
You're right. There are some exceptions, yeah. And he definitely is one.
Now, one thing I want to ask you, because I have been hesitating to go see 12 Years a Slave, because I know it's very upsetting and very violent. And it's a movie like that I often wait to see in the smaller screen, so it won't be so upsetting. But people have told me it's really not. It's not like going to see The Passion of the Christ, which was so upsetting. I had to leave in the middle of the movie because of the terrible, terrible violence. What do you think?
I think it's still. I maintain that everybody should see it. It is tough, but I don't think it's something that's going to send you reeling from the theater.
Okay.
But it because it really happened, and it's really as much about the psychology behind it all, because it's so intimately shot and it's such an intimate perspective for much of the film. You really are with Solomon Northup through his experiences. And so you feel like you're taking on what he has experienced. I think that's what makes it so tough. And you're trying to reconcile what you're experiencing along with him. It's not so much physically what you're seeing is so brutal. Yes, it is. But I don't think it's to the level of anything that Mel Gibson has done, because he's gone over the top.
Wait a second. When you said a minute ago you didn't think that Poehler and Faye were as funny as some of the rest of us, that you did not think her line saying it really changed my view about slavery, you didn't think that was a pretty good that was a pretty
right,
good line.
That was a good one. I agree.
Hey, Jared, thanks. We'll see you before the Academy Awards for sure. Thanks so much for your time.
Jared, thank you, guys.
Thank you. Jared Bowen is WGBH's arts editor and host of the TV show Open Studio. When we come back, we're going to talk to Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessing. He's taking this mission to end political corruption to the streets, why he is walking across New Hampshire. That's up next on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Joe Bergantino, the executive director of the New England Center for Investigative Reporting.
I'm Jennifer McKim.
I'm Rupa Shenoy.
I'm Beth Daly, a reporter.
A reporter.
A reporter with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting.
Now a partner in the WGBH newsroom.
Peer pressure usually gets a bad rap, but this week on Innovation Hub, we meet someone who's using it in inventive ways. I'm Kara Miller. Check it out. You know all your friends are going to be listening. That's tonight at 9 on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Olin College of Engineering, sponsor of Innovation Hub, heard Thursdays and Saturdays on WGBH. Olin, where a focus on the needs of people in the real world ignites passion and innovation. More at olin.edu. And the law firm of Wolf Greenfield. Specializing in intellectual property law, Wolf Greenfield provides clients with solutions on patents, trademarks, licensing, and litigation. WolfGreenfield.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. A year ago, the computer coder and internet freedom activist Aaron Swartz killed himself. He was facing prosecution on federal hacking charges and possibly decades in prison. In memory of Aaron Swartz, Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig is walking across New Hampshire. Lessig writes, quote, "I wanted to feel it as physically painful as it was emotionally painful 1 year ago and every moment since." Lessig's walk is more than a walk. It's a movement called the New Hampshire Rebellion. It's committed to a cause that meant a lot to Swartz, ending political corruption. Lawrence Lessig joins us from the road in North Conway. Lawrence, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for doing this.
Good morning. And as Jim said, thanks for joining us. So what exactly do you mean? You're marching both in memory of Aaron Swartz and to end political corruption. Explain that to our listeners.
Well, about 7 years ago, Aaron came to me and he said, you know, at that time I was working on copyright issues and internet issues, and he said to me, how do you think you're ever going to make any progress on those issues as long as we face this fundamental system of corruption? And I said, well, you know, it's not my expertise. And he said, I get it. It's not your expertise as an academic, but what about as a citizen? And he convinced me at that point, and I announced that someone was going to shift my work to focus on corruption. So this was a core passion. And he joined me to start a group called Change Congress to work on this issue. And that's the work I've been doing ever since. Now, we're marching across New Hampshire in memory of Aaron, and in honor of an extraordinary woman named Granny D, a New Hampshireite, who at the age of 88, 15 years ago, walked from L.A. to Washington with a sign in her chest that said campaign finance reform. And at the same time, John McCain came to New Hampshire, and he gave a famous speech in Bedford and talked about the system of corruption in Washington. And, of course, I think he won that primary in 2000. Because he made corruption the focus of his work. So we're trying to link together these very, very different people to revive in New Hampshire this movement that's focused on the system of corruption that we think blocks the ability of Congress to deal with any issue sensible.
And by the way, Granny D, for those who don't know her story, and it's a wonderful story, it lived to 100 and was really this hugely inspirational
part. Exactly. America. We should all start walking like you, Lawrence.
Now, Lawrence, you started in Dixville Notch, which obviously has significance to any political junkie. Dixville Notch is the town that votes at midnight, the first town to vote in the presidential primary. There are, I don't know, 12, 20, whatever number of people. Every outlet reports it. So is the goal is for this to catch on and to be a central theme in the presidential primaries, where obviously there'll be an open seat for the presidency. That's the center of this thing, is it not?
That's right. We're going to be marching three times between now and the primary in 2016. And we're going to recruit 100,000 people from New Hampshire to pledge that this is their issue and to guarantee that every time a presidential candidate opens his mouth or her mouth in New Hampshire, the first question they get is, how are you going to end the system of corruption in Washington? And we expect that if we have a significant number of New Hampshire voters, now there are only 750,000 voters in New Hampshire, and the difference between Clinton and Obama in 2008 was 8,000 votes. If we have a significant chunk of New Hampshire voters committed to this, which we believe they are, then I think we have a chance to make this an issue in 2016.
Are you walking as you're talking to us, Lawrence?
Yeah, unfortunately, I am.
No, it's great. No, I noticed you were slightly out of breath, and I was admiring.
Yeah, really hard, icy conditions. But as you hear that, you know, we're by a road, and people drive by us, and they honk in support. It's been really amazing. We've passed people who put signs on their in front of their houses, welcome to the Granny D. Walkers. It's been an incredible welcoming here in New Hampshire.
You know, Lawrence Lessig, my colleague here, Jim Browdy, has something called yak tracks that he puts in the bottom of his shoes for the sort of like, do you have special treads? I mean, it's serious up there, walking in the morning in the ice in New Hampshire. What are you doing?
Yeah, so I did have Yak Track. I, in fact, had Yak Track Pros. They lasted one day.
I'm sorry.
I've got another much more aggressive pair of red things on my feet right now.
You know, one thing I think that's exciting about what you're doing is, as you point out in a couple of pieces you've written in The Atlantic, that there's a bipartisan urge to end this campaign finance reform corruption. You talk about, you know, people on the left like you, they want climate change reform, healthcare reform, sensible internet policy, and the right wants smaller government and simpler taxes. And so you could get both, as you say, the right and the left behind you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we did a poll just before this march started, a national poll, and we found 96% of Americans believe the influence of money in politics needs to be reduced. 96%. So I've been doing this little shtick where I, you know, meet people and I say, are you part of the 4%? I'm looking for the 4% because I want to know who those people are, you know, because 96% is a pretty unanimous consensus in the United States. But the reason politicians don't talk about this issue is that though 96% think it's an important issue, actually, 68% think it's a very important issue, but okay, 90%, 96% think it's important. 91% of Americans don't believe it will ever be cured.
So why do you, Lawrence? I think I speak for Marjorie, and what you're doing is terrific and inspirational. And I hope people join you. And we're going to tell them in a minute how they can, if they choose. What was the last piece of evidence that suggests that Congress in Washington care at all what the public thinks? 90-some% of the public wanted background checks, and they couldn't even pass a modified background check. So why do you believe that there'll be some grassroots rising up, a rebellion, as you call it, a New Hampshire rebellion, is going to change anything?
Well, I do believe that this primary is central for setting the tone of the presidential election. And I do believe it's completely possible to recruit 50,000 or 100,000 New Hampshireites to this. But here's the fundamental point. We've got to. We have a government that does not function. It cannot address the most basic issues. And it cannot, in my view, because we've allowed this cancer of a system for funding elections to metastasize. We've got to find a way. And so, you know, this is in some sense crazy. But if you look at crazy, let me tell you, if crazy knows crazy, I think the crazy here is our Congress, right? Those guys spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money to get back to Congress. They stand on an empty floor of Congress talking to themselves, believing that on C-SPAN millions of people are watching, right? If you're ever on Capitol Hill, you know, it's like an elementary school. The bells ring. They race down for procedural votes that mean nothing. They don't even know what they're voting on. That system is crazy, and we've got to match their craziness to build a rebellion strong enough to force them to change, and I think we can do it. I mean, I've been amazed with the passion of people up here around this issue. Scream out of their cars, their support.
Really?
I'm totally surprised by this. I thought, you know, they would just wonder who we are, but as we walk, there's an incredible rallying, and if we can crack the 91%, we can give them a sense there's a reason to hope. And I think there's a chance to motivate a reform movement unlike anything we've seen. There is no issue with this amount of support. So let's try to give them a sense of a map of how we can win, and I think we'll win.
We're talking with Harvard professor Lawrence Lessing, who right now, this moment, is walking across the state of New Hampshire in memory of Aaron Swartz and also in a campaign to end the political corruption, the influence of money on our politics. Tell people who may not know much about Aaron. You were close with him. You knew him. He took his life almost a year ago. Tell people a little bit more about him.
Yeah, so I knew Aaron for, you know, probably 10 or a dozen years of his life. He died when he was 26. And the whole time I knew him, his sole focus was on working to make the world a better place according to his vision, doing whatever he could. You know, he almost by accident became wealthy because he was one of the co-founders of Reddit. That wealth gave him the opportunity to be solely focused on trying to advance the ideas and the movements that he cared about. And the most striking thing to me, you know, when he died, there had been no major press about Aaron Swartz in the whole of his life. There's, you know, no New York Times interview, no television interview. There hadn't been publicists sort of pushing Aaron Swartz. So from the media's perspective, he was invisible. But millions of people that first day rallied in incredible support and really, it was outrage, depression over what had happened because he had touched so many people in this internet culture. He had connected and built and supported for exactly the best possible reasons. And so, I think he's an inspiration. I'm in an interview, in a radio interview right now. Thank you.
We'll let you go in a second, Lawrence. Finish your thought. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so he had inspired so many people by this genuine passion to do right and do good. And I think many of us thought, if we have a government that can't tell the difference between somebody who hacks for the purpose of stealing credit cards and somebody like this, then we have an incredible blindness in our government that we also have to fix.
I hope they're not after you, those sirens. They're not. Lawrence Lessing, thank you very much
for
joining us, and good luck on your walk, and I hope you don't slip on the ice.
Thank you.
Thanks
for doing this.
Lawrence Lessing is a professor of law at Harvard Law School and director of the Edmund J. Soffer Center for Ethics at Harvard University. To learn more about the New Hampshire Rebellion and the walk across New Hampshire, go to nhrebellion.org.
And the hashtag is NHR, as in New Hampshire Rebellion, walk. Do you believe he had yak tracks for a day? I couldn't believe. I assume when you asked that question, he was going to say, what are yak tracks? But he's used them. So we have Lawrence Lessig, a professor at Harvard Law School of some repute, walking across New Hampshire to protest corruption in government and trying to make a change, and obviously in memory of his friend who killed himself just about a year ago, Aaron Swartz. And we want to compare that to the rest of America, where we protest nothing. There is virtually nothing that anybody, any government, any corporation can do to us that would cause us to go to a rally, to walk across New Hampshire, even to walk across the street. Here's what we do if we get really exercised, Marjorie. Maybe we write a check. Maybe we send an email. More likely to scream at the radio or TV. Compare that to the rest of the world. How many people were in Tahrir Square? 20 million?
I don't
10
know.
Million?
Millions.
How about the stories? And our number, by the way, is 877-301-8970. We're hoping you can explain to us why America has why the protest in America has gone the way of the Edsel. I mean, essentially, it's extinct in Western Europe, in Canada. Do you remember the stories when they raised college tuition, state tuitions, a modest amount of money?
Or when they tried to cut pensions in some of these countries.
There were
in
tens of thousands of people in the street. And, with the exception of the relatively short-lived Occupy movement, which obviously is an exception to this rule, when was the last time there was a rally of even 200 people in and around Great? You know what it was? You wrote about it, and I took a lot of heat for talking about it, the Puppy Doe Rally in Quincy around the time when that dog was abused and ultimately died.
And hundreds of people. You know what we do, though? We do walks. I mean, the Walk for Hunger every year is about, 40,000 people? Marathons. We're big into walks and road races. We don't seem to be big into protests. I mean, when I think of the ones, the most recent protest that I can think of, besides Occupy's, when we did, there was a Million Man March to Washington.
Everybody, you told me years ago, you and your older daughter, who was then in her teens,
yep,
I think.
There was a NOW.
You went to a NOW, National Organization for Women rally in Washington.
We went to
Washington.
That. There were the second Iraq War, I don't remember so well because it was after 9/11, of course, but there were war protests in Washington after the first.
You mean Bush the Elder.
Before the first Iraq War, yeah. And there were. But, God, we don't really protest much at all.
So we want to know if you can help us out. Why do you think that has changed? And, by the way, if you think we're wrong, feel free to disabuse us. And a corollary question is, what would it take for you to go to a protest or a rally in favor? And I don't mean, a feel-good kind of thing, but something that was really serious, that mattered to you a lot, that mattered to your community, mattered to your family. I mean, the more I talk, the more I realize there are occasionally some local things. When there's a local issue, the closer to home it is, I guess people do. But there are no grand protests. There are no grand anything. Yeah. People are so – and I bet your talk radio is in part responsible for this. Because you can vent, as I said, through email, through calling a radio show, through screaming at a talk television screen – people have basically, they have taken up full-time residency on their couches. And that's why when you hear this Lessig guy who could pay tribute to his friend Aaron Swartz in many other ways, that he's walking across New Hampshire in the winter, intends to do it, what, two more times, I think, before the presidential primaries
in
January of 2016, good for him. 877-301-8970. So help us out if you can.
Let us start with Paul in Milton. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Paul.
Hi, Marjorie. Jim, how are you?
Great.
Fine. What do you think?
Two factors. I think Pat Ochavsky's network was probably a generation ahead of itself. And Neil Postman, tell
people what he screamed at the window, Paul.
Yeah, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take
it anymore.
That's right.
Yeah.
And
they're all happy with their then radial tires, which I guess were a big thing. And, you know, as long as, they had their possessions, they were happy and didn't. Of course, his idea was they turned protesting in the movie, I guess, into a product, which they could sell. And I guess once you can sell something, maybe you can get people to respond. And I believe he's a Northeastern University professor, or was, Neil Postman. He wrote something called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which came out in the 80s. And basically said he was often quoted by Jerry Williams years ago.
For whom you used to work, Paul, for those who don't know. Yeah.
Thank you. And still miss, by the way.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of people.
As to talk radio, I mean, demographically, except for this program, I wonder whether they are reaching an element that I was going to say are confined to walkers, but I think like Rush's demographics must be
very old in the 70s.
Very old.
Yeah.
I mean, and then they weren't going to get out there to protest anything. So I'm not sure that talk radio maybe soothes that element. But growing up in the 60s as I did, and I didn't do a whole lot of protesting except attend a Gene McCarthy rally. I'm sorry?
Oh, I think we lost you there, Paul. Well, he said except attending a Gene McCarthy rally, but by attending a Gene McCarthy
rally,
you're essentially protesting the war. So, I mean, and that is, obviously, I just got a text from a friend of mine, said, don't forget the Tea Party movement, don't forget don't forget
they
that Colbert and Stewart got all those people to Washington.
Great point.
There are exceptions. There clearly are exceptions. But I guess what I was talking about is sort of maybe, and I should have articulated this better, more of a Lessig kind of thing. Not some huge organized thing by celebrities or major politicians, but just people who are enraged about the state of affairs in their community, their state, their country, who say, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore, and they do something like Lessig is doing this week up there in New Hampshire.
Sheila just emailed and said, we're crazy for candlelight vigils.
Yeah, well, there's some of that too.
And that's true, but that's sort of an after
but that's
the
more
fact
honor.
Of a tragedy.
Exactly,
it's not to get out there and protest something.
And by the way, for those who don't think that leaders, whether they're corporate leaders or political leaders, don't include that in their calculation about their behaviors, I think they know there's very little. What percentage of the American people are upset about the NSA snooping? A vast majority. Is that correct?
Yep.
What's happening about that?
Nothing.
And tomorrow the president allegedly in the morning or sometime is going to say, as we mentioned yesterday,
he's Todd Zwillick,
we're going to snoop more to ensure that we don't have any more Edward Snowdens.
Yeah,
apparently they're going to monitor the monitors to make sure that doesn't happen. How about gun control?
I know that most Americans, as you said, 90-some percent want gun control. And as he said when we were speaking to him, most Americans are very upset about campaign finance reform. They're convinced as well that the corruption in government is linked to money.
And what's the second half of what he said is 90-some percent of the people want it. 91% say they don't think it's going to happen. And you know what it is? It's a pogo-esque problem. The enemy is us. The reason it's not going to happen is because all we do is express our aggravation to pollsters.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
Of course, I always thought that one of the big things that was going on, a lot of the anti-war rallies in the 60s was guys went to pick up girls. Wasn't that the real story?
There may have been some of those. I'm not sure. It's just a totally different mentality. There really is.
Brian in Austin, Texas. Oh, my goodness. Hi,
hey, Brian.
Hi. I should make clear two things. First, I'm working with the New Hampshire Rebellion, but I am not authorized officially to speak on their behalf. So what I'm saying comes from me as a private citizen. I think I might have an answer to your question.
Okay.
Why people don't protest, I think it's because people kind of realize, as you said, 91% of people say that you can't really solve the campaign finance problem. And I think that people realize that even if they were to show up in droves, and they have in the past, the special interests, the elite, whatever you want to call them, the people who fund campaigns can block any significant reform on any of the what you'd call branch issues, whether it's gun control, whether it's NSA oversight. They can block progress on that. So people have learned over time that protesting these branch issues is futile. What we need to do is we really need to strike at the root issue, which is the systemic corruption. And I think that that's why this protest in New Hampshire is unlike a lot of protests, in that it is geared to making sure that this root issue is addressed first. Because if we can address the issue that people feel powerless, that people feel that there's nothing that can be done, they're going to start protesting. But the only way we're going to do that is if we actually give them reason to believe that that there's something that can be done.
And well, let me just say, Brian, the other thing that you're not saying, that I don't know if Lawrence made this point, I can't remember or not. I used to do tax reform, and one of the reasons we were moderately successful is tax reform in tough times and raising taxes in tough times unites all kinds of different constituencies that never work together. The beauty of the cause that you and Lessig and others are working on, this New Hampshire Rebellion thing, is the corrupting influence of money in politics affects everybody's issue. A gun control advocate can stand next to somebody who's worried that there's not enough money for social workers to make sure that the Jeremiah Olivers of the world aren't taking – I mean, it essentially affects everything, and that's why it's – while it hasn't been a huge hot-button issue in the past, there is potential if people like Lessig and others take it seriously. Brian, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Well, you know, there's a great anecdote out of Beacon Hill in Boston where if five or six constituents call you up, or maybe now five or six constituents email you, they consider that an avalanche of voter attention, and they will step up the pace on whatever the issue is they're talking about. I think one of the things that goes on in the United States is that because we, as citizens, just sit back and take a lot of this stuff, and we don't protest, as the caller was just saying, or as Lessig saying up in New Hampshire, we don't keep at it. I mean,
But there's another reason.
We are not powerless.
But there's another problem. Even if it turns out you were right, and I think historically it's true, a handful of calls could make a huge difference. That was the case in a different environment. You said to one of our guests the other day something that was totally true. I used to be a lobbyist at the State House, and I used the term loosely, a couple of decades ago. In those days, if you worked on a hot-button issue like budget issues in Massachusetts, if you're at a budget session at midnight and you were a leader of a key constituency and you held a press conference impromptu, you'd have four television stations there to do it. Nobody covers the State House anymore unless there's a big fight or an indictment. I'm sure they're all there today because of Carlos Center. But the point is,
why
politicians will be less responsive if they know the media is not watching.
Anybody cover the State House anymore?
Well, I don't know why.
Because citizens do not want to watch stories about the State House.
Maybe.
I mean, it's all about, I mean, the media is in business to make money. And they discovered a long time ago that people were not interested in process government, as they call it. So they were not going to run stories about
it. I'd say there's another reason for my, and again, this may be aberrational here, but I don't know if it is. There are too many lambs now. And when I was
too many lambs?
Lambs. When I used to be at the State House, everybody was fighting. Everybody who stood for something, which was, 30%, 40%, who actually fought. So there was a good conflict story. I don't mean conflict for the sake of conflict. Conflict because people disagreed on issues that mattered. Now the power is so consolidated in so few people, and it's not just here. It's in Washington as well, that those kinds of stories that would engage people are fewer in number. Let's take one more quick one. Lita, you're in Watertown. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi, Lita.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for the call.
I was actually talking to my husband about this the other day. I just think my generation sucks. I'm 34, and I think we're too fat, we're too happy, we watch TV, we drink wine, we eat chocolate, and we don't care. And it's really sad. really, really sad.
But and why? I think you describe the factual reality, but why? Why are people too figuratively fat and happy? Why don't they care?
I think maybe we get our catharsis from watching TV. I don't know. I mean, I don't know about everyone else, but I'm so tired at the end of the day that the idea of protesting anything, even though I'm disgusted about gun reform. I mean, I'm originally from Scotland, and the fact that people can have guns here and go out and shoot people, it doesn't make any sense. But none of it is any reality, because you watch Die Hard and the baddies get it. You know what I mean? So just think that I think we're so apathetic as a generation. And I wish we weren't. I wish we could just, you know, fight back. And
by the way, I think, as I said before, Lita, and that was a great call. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Because the vast majority of people in power in this country, in whatever forum you're talking about, know that what Lita says is true, they're willing to be bolder in what they do, in a bad way, I would suggest, because they know what the reaction or non-reaction is going to be, which is really horrible.
You know, there's a great line in one of these stories about why we don't protest. It says that Americans are trained to believe that nothing major is wrong, whether it's climate change or economic meltdown or preventable diseases, etc. You name it, we're ready to downplay it. We're Americans, God damn it, we'll figure out a way to fix it. When the going gets tough, we'll call the experts. I think there is a sense of that, too. But I think that's changing, because I used to think when the going gets tough, Congress would start acting like grown-ups and fix things. Now I don't think that's true anymore, so I'm depressed, Jim.
Well, see, let me just end this by saying I don't agree with that at all. I think most Americans think everything is wrong. In fact, Obamacare is horrible. The climate is horrible. Congress is horrible. But we still do very little. Thanks for your calls. We appreciate
it. Okay, Jim. You're wrong. I'm right. But
well,
that's
maybe,
okay.
Maybe I am.
Coming up is Open Mic with Alex Beam. We're going to talk about navigating daily dilemmas and a little bit about what's going on at Mile High Stadium. That's up next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Around here, January means the start of another season of Downton Abbey on Masterpiece. And if you love checking in with the English aristocracy from the comfort of your sofa, how about experiencing the real thing? WGBH Learning Tours presents England Upstairs, the World of the Gentry. You'll fly to England for 10 days, explore the world of the lords and ladies, and even be invited to Highclere Castle. Space is extremely limited. Details at wgbh.org/learningtours.
We love our contributors. That means you. And the Baker Library Bloomberg Center at Harvard Business School, now exhibiting the art of American advertising with ads, trade cards, and catalogs from the dawn of modern advertising. Info at library.hbs.edu. And Celebrity Series of Boston, presenting bass baritone Gerald Finley performing Schubert's Winterreise with pianist Julius Drake on Friday, February 7th at NEC's Jordan Hall. You can learn more at celebrityseries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 for Open Mic is Globe columnist Alex Beam. And as you know, Marjorie and I were discussing this yet again this morning. We'd call him Beam even if it weren't his birth name. Why was that, Marjorie? Because he is like a sunbeam toaster. I'm not done yet. What a toaster is to bread, Alex is to the blank page. Put a piece of white paper in Alex's hands and out comes something searing and oftentimes crusty. I don't think I could have said it better myself. In fact, I did say it myself.
That's just brilliant, Jim, and kudos to your amazing writing staff.
Thank you very much. Welcome back, Alex Beam. Good to see you.
Thank you, sir. You don't say that with the least bit of sense.
No, I was very excited to see you. You are wearing the exact same sweater you wore two appearances ago, though, I should say.
Really? How observant you are.
But I've upgraded my whole look.
But you look good in it. You do.
Thank you very much.
It's sort of an orangey turtleneck there underneath the sweater.
You know, this is a
mock turtle.
It's from the remainder bin. This color has always remaindered.
Burnt orange.
Alex, do you remember this is not one of our topics, but since Marjorie mentioned what is it called? Faux turtle? What's that thing called?
Mock turtle.
Mock turtle. Do you remember the Dickie from your youth? Do you remember what a Dickie was?
I know what it's the weirdest word in the world.
I know it is.
And I do know what it is.
Could you describe what it was for the, let's say, 20-somethings who don't know what it is?
Did you wear them?
Yes, I did. Okay, I'll tell what it is.
Okay, I don't know. Dickies just are so weird.
A Dickie was a little mock turtle top. Like, it looked like a turtleneck thing. And what it was attached to, which no one could see under your shirt or sweater, was a bib-like thing.
Yeah.
So it appeared like you had a turtleneck shirt on underneath your shirt. But what you had was, what was it called again, please?
A dickie.
A dickie.
But you know what it's really analogous to? You know, the only people who wear that now are priests and clerics. That's the way the clerical collar, it comes down here. So it's raised here and has white. So it's a man's V-neck, but it's really just a dickie.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That's my least
dickie?
Favorite word in the world.
Why don't they just attach it to their shirt? It would be so much more regular.
And women would never get involved with something like a dickie.
No. Well, actually, I think they were popular for women, too, when I was a kid. Yes,
yikes.
I think girls wore
dickies,
too.
I'm very disappointed to hear that.
That is a full mock turtle. That is not a dickie you're wearing, correct? The orange
thing? No, this is a legitimately remainder. This color is coral, by the way.
Coral.
Not burnt orange.
And
it's fraying. I have a rule that's when my shirts start to fray, I have to throw them out. But I really like this because it's always half price because they make these and then no one buys them. And
perfect.
For half price. Yeah, exactly.
For good reason.
So, Alex, you probably have written about this, but we were just talking about before you got here, why Americans don't protest much anymore. Like the Europeans are always out in the street protesting. If somebody wants to, take 6 months off their retirement, their early retirement, if they're in the public, working for the public sector, or of course the Egyptians, the famous Arab Spring. What's wrong with us?
What's wrong? I was listening to the show. I don't know. You've already had ample input, haven't you? I mean, oddly, I bet everybody among the three of us probably did protest, right?
Yeah.
Like, even I
covered them.
A long time ago.
Against
them.
Everything.
What was the last protest you were at?
Oh, that's Jesus. Wow. I mean, I remember I campaigned for McCarthy, right? Like, everybody campaigned for McCarthy. I don't know. Protests, that's a good question. But, because the stupid Globe where I worked for 88 years wouldn't allow you to take a stand on anything. So
Wait, even as a columnist?
Absolutely as a columnist.
Well, yeah,
least
you couldn't
of all,
really go to
You can't go to things.
But you know what was always great about that? They'll give you a great excuse when someone wanted you to donate money to some
Or
cause.
To sign a petition
or
something.
I can't do it. I'm a reporter.
Yes. And all those walks that you mentioned earlier, I begged off most
But why, right. assuming you agree with us that we're right, that the political protest is the aberration in 2013, 2014... Why is that?
I actually respectfully don't agree. I heard you got some good churn, just before I came on. I mean, it's weird. I didn't hear anybody mention something that I have only the vaguest recollection of. But Lessig, of all people, would know. Don't you remember when they proposed two analogous bills with really strange acronyms that were going to have a sort of a deleterious effect on the internet? There was this amazing protest, admittedly an online protest, and those two bills were withdrawn.
No, that doesn't count. You didn't hear the beginning of the
session. Doesn't count.
My view is writing a check, sending an email, engaging, and by the way, it's perfectly fine because, as we know, Arab Spring in huge part was a social media created thing, but people hit the streets. I'm talking about I should have said it this
physical.
Way, where you actually inconvenience yourself to participate in something that, and with all due respect, engaging in an internet protest
or
is not a huge inconvenience.
Org.
You'd be sitting in your
now.
Underwear on your couch doing it. So, I mean,
remember the Seabrook nuclear power plant protests? Those were huge.
Yeah. I had a baton beating up protesters. Just a joke,
nice.
Of course. Anti-nuclear really wasn't my issue. I don't know. I don't know when the last time I got off the couch. Frankly,
what would get you off the couch? Assuming the Globe didn't say to you, you may not.
I would eagerly. My memory is incredibly faulty. But I would eagerly work for any politician in America, Democrat or Republican. I really believe in the people who put themselves on the line, and I've worked. Locally, I've done, and I would distribute stuff. I would do that because I guess I'm a completely upside down person. I heard what Lessig said, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think it takes, a lot of stamina, a lot of courage, a lot of extroversion, a lot of self-confidence to run for office in America. And then I would get off my ass and have, I think, to be fair, gotten off my ass to work for people who are willing to go into politics.
How could you do that as a columnist and reporter for the Globe?
Tell them.
Exactly.
You're sneaky about it?
I have two names, conveniently. You know, my name isn't Alex Beam. Unbelievably. So that works.
We
for
would
me.
Call you bit. No, we said
yeah.
that.
So
right.
you've done it under your assumed name.
I do it under my assumed
now,
name.
Now, Alex,
yes.
you wrote a rather odd column that was in the paper today.
Thank you, Marjorie. There's nothing odd about it.
It was the Bard or the Broncos. Explain to people what your dilemma, your conundrum was, I guess.
Yeah, well, it really hit me. I guess Sunday this past. I like the Patriots. I'm really into the Patriots. I think this is an interesting run. Blah 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 blah. I couldn't believe that. First of all, they had Saturday at 8:15 was an outrageous time to watch a playoff game.
When they
game.
Played the Colts last
yeah,
week.
Yeah, because my 12-year-old was up till like, my 12-year-old nephew was up till like midnight. That was hard. And then they announced this 3 p.m., Sunday 3 p.m. I don't know. I get it. It's all about the West Coast, blah, 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 blah. But incredibly, I've been waiting months. I once saw this famous Shakespearean actor named Mark Rylance in a production, which frankly many of your listeners probably saw, called Jerusalem. It was in both London and New York. It was an amazing contemporary British play. Rylance is a really big deal. Rylance has rewritten Shakespeare. He's a really big deal. He's a great, great actor. Anyway, my friend, who works at an incredibly influential publication, the name of which we can't divulge, got me and my wife tickets to see Richard III, 12th night,
New York
Sunday
Times?
At 3 p.m. No, Vanity Fair, because they have actual clout.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Richard III, Sunday at 3. I mean, like, it's a complete nightmare for me. And I'm not, to use the euphemism, an iPhone bleep. I obviously won't say that yet. But I just got
Richard III, I thought it was 12th night.
I misspoke.
Oh.
They're going, they're in repertory, Richard III and 12th night, with Rylance.
So what are you seeing?
I'm seeing 12th night.
Okay.
So the dilemma for you, just so the people are clear, you had tickets for 12th night at the exact same time that this historic matchup between Peyton Manning and Tom Brady and others will happen out there in Denver. And you made what choice, as you disclosed in the column, and why?
Well, I'm not saying I feel really good about it. I'm going to New York, where my wife lives and works, and I'm going to see Rylance, and actually won't be at you have to get there at 2:30. I got a lot of feedback from readers. A lot of Globe readers have actually seen this show. You have to get there at 2:30 because they start arranging the stage in the manner of the old Globe Theater. Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Niche.
Yeah, I'm kind of psyched. It's going to be great. As I wrote in the column, I have this really weird love affair with Twelfth Night, which I've never seen, because it's mentioned in Shakespeare in Love.
Yes, and your great line when you talk about the beautiful closing scene in Shakespeare in Love with Gwyneth Paltrow as Viola.
I went
walking
back
down the beach.
Oh, it blew my mind.
It's beautiful.
It's so romantically
done. Great.
In that movie, which is such a great
movie. I love that movie.
Did you say you love this column?
Yes.
It's ridiculous. Now, let me explain.
That's why I admire you.
Let me explain
a couple
of things
here. I
thought
so too, by the way.
Don't you remember that last scene in Shakespeare in Love? If people haven't seen Shakespeare in Love,
they should
go. It's just the
most
best.
People have seen it.
Yeah, they
I
have.
Hope
now,
so.
Here it won the Academy Award. Now, listen to
it
this
did?
For a second. Yeah, it did.
Oh.
And here, listen
yeah,
to this.
What do you know?
Listen to this reasoning. My thinking, and this is Alex Beam writing. I've seen the Tom Brady, Peyton Manning matchup before, but I've never seen 12th Night. And then it goes on. But you are aware that 12th Night will probably be played again. You know that. And Manning versus Brady 15 will not happen again.
You're just a Philistine, okay?
Do you understand?
And that's really being revealed.
I'm not done yet. Now, let me explain to you.
I can't believe that.
What Alex
You
does.
Didn't even hear of Mark Rylance before I walked in the door.
Of course I
Admit
haven't.
It.
I still haven't heard of him.
Yeah,
now,
okay,
let me explain
fine,
something
exactly.
else to you. What Alex does is takes this issue, this Hobson's Choice, as he says, you know, between the Patriots and 12th Night, and gives other examples. And he does not miss another opportunity, even though we're kind enough to invite him here every Tuesday to do the following. Here's another one. For instance, number one, to A, watch Downton Abbey, or B, show up for my regularly scheduled colonoscopy. And by the way, as you probably know, if you heard him last week,
so many of my readers were happy to hear me weigh in on Downton Abbey.
It's only the biggest public television show ever, so let's decide
exactly.
who knows
and
what
do,
they're
and
talking
we do
about.
Nothing but, yeah. but shout hosannas and praises to it here.
Why
in
don't you
field.
Read number three? I can't
yeah, you do it
quite
good.
See Alex celebrating the pagan drum circle at sunset on the beach someplace in Florida, swilling beer and pounding on an empty soup
That's the
pot.
Price I pay for a free ride to Peckerwood Alley. This guy has a bungalow that's like three blocks off the beach, and he loves to go to this drum circle. It's a pretty big deal on the Gulf Coast of Florida.
Is that like a man thing, or what is that?
It's a boy-girl thing,
but
all superannuated hippies, all your pot good. Crowd, by the way, the subject you're so eager to discuss. It's all these like super gray-haired, weird people who got left out of the California thing, so they had to drift to the Gulf Coast of Florida.
And what do they do? Go out in the forest somewhere?
Like it's on the beach.
It's on the
it's
beach?
At sunset. Some women take their clothes off.
They do?
If you can believe it.
Wow.
And by the way, you didn't mention what the choice was. It was either celebrate the pagan drum circle in Florida, or what was the alternative that he had to deal with?
The choice was to go hear at Yale Divinity School professor Peter Hawken expatiate?
Yeah.
Who knows what that means?
On the Psalms and their literary afterlife at the Trinity Church.
The only reason I put that in there was because I kind of wanted to make fun of the Episcopalians who will, like, have something in their basement and then call it an undercroft. I mean, are you joking? I mean, it's in the basement, okay?
So
I got the word undercroft into the Boston
Globe. I know, I didn't know what that meant either.
Of course. Nobody knows what that means.
Let me just, again, Bard versus the Broncos. What time do you have to be at the theater?
3 p.m.
So
Exactly.
Game starts at 3. Will you be watching? This is the true test of where his heart is. Will you be watching any of the pregame festivities before you go to the theater?
I hate pregame, and I was about to bore the world with. I mean, I just got a smartphone. I hate it. I'm not even going to bring my smartphone. I will go up to somebody at intermission. Obviously, there'll be a concerned New Englander or Colorado. I'll go up to somebody at intermission and say what the score.
Did you read the Herald today?
I'm not watching it either.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not.
Did you read the Herald
Is this
today?
A trick question?
No, did you read the Herald today?
Okay, no, I didn't.
Okay, fine.
Shame on you.
Tell him, speaking of the Patriots
game. Thank God we're two newspaper towns.
This is
the other thing we want to mention.
That's
what your new owner said.
What's the story about the game and the prominent story about the game?
This is pretty funny, that Patriot fans are hitting up Denver pot shops before the big game because, of course, marijuana is now legal in Denver. So all these people, they interview this one guy, and you have to give them your ID, of course. That's how the shop owner knows, the pot shop owner. He said, we've had at least 45 people so far, and almost all of them were there to see the Patriots game. But there's an upside. They think that the cannabis will help keep things under control, happy and calm, and less violent at the stadium.
I read that story, thanks to your crack staff, which provided it to me. And let me say, by the way, that story is a lot better than the analogous story that ran in the Boston Globe.
Which was what?
The Globe did the same story in a much, much weaker version. So that was hilarious that the Herald picked up this angle that it was going to mellow out.
Tabloid.
The feisty tabloid. That was a much better story.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely great. So I guess people got out there early so they could go into the store and buy.
But there's no reefer allowed in the inappropriately named Mile High Stadium. Alas.
Mile High Stadium. That's right. But apparently they don't really crack down on it in a big time kind of way. And also you could just buy the pot and eat your brownies at the stadium.
I guess you've got this.
Can we stay on the subject of marijuana?
22% grass tax out there on the marijuana. So the state is taking a big chunk of the money.
Well, New Hampshire is proposing 30%.
Well, not only proposing, the House of Representatives in New Hampshire, despite the fact that the governor said she would veto it, the House of Representatives, I think yesterday or the day before, passed a legalization, not decriminalization, legalization of marijuana bill. $30 an ounce tax would go to the state, by the way, which was a big thing. The reason we wanted to talk to you about this was not so much whether you're for or against legalization, even though you can speak to that. Joan Vinaki took issue with another story, a quote in a story that was in the Globe the other day. They were talking about how young voters are abandoning Barack Obama in droves, huge numbers. Well, they are.
Whatever.
And Tad Devine, who's a Democratic strategist, is quoted, and Joan quotes him a second time, saying legalization of marijuana is going to become an issue. I believe it's an issue that will absolutely activate a voter base of young people in particular. She takes issue with that.
That's a terrific column, by the way. That's Joan at her crotchety best.
It's
saying
today.
Like,
it's smoke signals
it's
from the
it's
Democrats.
It's really worth reading.
Do you agree with her take that it's ridiculous to think that that's what's going to bring young voters out to embrace
the
Democrats?
Present company, you know that I have the highest regard. That column is great edge. I just like the fact that she's being really nasty and calling out these Democratic hypocrites.
So
and
you agree with her?
I do agree with her. And I think that poll quote is fascinating.
If Democrats need pot to get out the youth vote, they really do have something to worry about.
Yeah, I sort of salute her for saying that. I think a younger columnist might not have written that. I think she makes a really great argument that it's just a cynical vote grab. And in her opinion, I don't know, you should phone her, frankly. She probably thinks it's, just not a good idea.
But wait a second, it's not just about young voters. The point that I think both Tad Devine missed, and I think you're missing as well, is the appeal of this as an issue for Democrats, assuming they embrace it, is it has huge appeal to a broader stretch of the electorate, which is a huge number of people and a growing number of people are libertarian-leaning. Maybe not Rand and Ron Paul libertarian, but most people I know are developing a libertarian streak, even if they're liberals or conservatives. That's why I think this marijuana legalization has a huge, huge appeal.
Well, we'll see if you're right. I don't know if you're right.
Was that cutting edge too or not?
No, because you don't have the verbal abilities of a Boston Globe columnist, with all due respect.
That's okay.
Anybody can run their mouth on the radio.
They can.
But on a serious note, I mean,
not everybody, actually.
Touche. I like that. You're a feisty lady yourself.
Okay.
Fine. All right. What's your point?
You know, what's interesting is that this gay marriage, a couple of other issues that aren't, excuse me, state organized health care. What's darned in Vermont, Massachusetts, and now what's darned interesting is that we're going to see. We don't have to hypothesize about the legalization of marijuana. We have a purple state, Colorado, with an interesting we'll just see. We'll have, Maggie Hassan.
We'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, we'll see how it plays out. And in Massachusetts, Vermont, I mean, we're seeing how state organized health care plays out. So rather than say, oh, it's not working, oh, it's a disaster, let's see. I mean, and that's genuinely interesting.
Let's see, what is it that you expect to see in Colorado or Washington State, which obviously are the only two where voters have approved the legalization of marijuana? What do you expect to see that would convince an open-minded person? I don't mean somebody's in the tank to either side to say, oh, I was open-minded, but now this is a bad idea. What's going to happen?
Well, first of all, that's a great question. Second of all, suppose like crapola street crime declined.
That would be great.
Okay.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
But I'm saying, what is the possible bad thing
addicts. More addicts. Isn't that the bad thing?
I really feel an open-minded person would say it could go either way. You know, my kid dropped out of high school because he was earning money fixing cars, and he spent all the money smoking legal pot, and he's a wreck. I don't know. That's a bad story for a parent.
I
think it's going to be very similar to gay marriage. I think what's going to happen is virtually nothing, except that Colorado is going to be making a lot of money, tax revenues in this, and that there may be some slight increase in people. I just don't think that illegality is what prevents people who want to smoke pot from smoking pot.
I'm with you.
Yeah, I'm with you on the laboratory aspect, and that's why I mentioned gay marriage, about which it's very easy to have a strong I mean, let's see. I mean, we've lived in this state for 10 years.
I think that's what will happen.
Right?
I think that's
we
got to
go.
Be
Can you do
argument?
Me one favor? Could you email me? No, I'm serious. Could you email me after the pagan drum circle and tell me what it was like?
I'll send you a photograph.
That's what I was hoping for, my friend. Thank you.
But I'll be shirtless, so you might not want to print that photograph.
I don't need that picture.
Yeah, why is that the experience of topless beaches? The people you want to see in the topless beaches are never there.
Exactly. It's the Alex Beams, not the Marjorie Egans.
It's a pleasure, as always.
Stay in school, you two.
Absolutely.
All right.
Alex Beam joins us every Thursday. We love to talk to Alex Beam. Up next, we love to talk to Kara Miller. She's going to tell us about innovation hubs are not just Silicon Valley and over in Kendall Square. They are popping up all around the world. Kara Miller up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
If you're like most people, you rely on a wide variety of sources for the news of the day. I'm John Hockenberry, and on The Takeaway, we draw on our partners, the New York Times, the WGBH Boston Public Radio folks, and experts from around the country, so you can better understand your world. Listen to all the sources each weekday on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Bentley University joining with Bloomberg Radio to examine millennials in the workforce live on January 29th. More information available online at bentley.edu/prepared. That's bentley.edu/prepared. And This Old House, renovation of the 1872 Italianate home in Arlington continues, the project being led by general contractor Tom Silva. Don't miss This Old House, Thursday at 8 on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Kara Miller is here. What'd you say? It's right?
That's correct.
Fine.
I thought you'd forgotten my name.
Kara Miller joins us. She does every, what day is this?
Thursday.
To tell us that Silicon Valley apparently isn't the only game in town. Innovation hubs are sprouting up across the world, not just in the United States. Joining us to talk about the globalization of innovation, I like that line, is Kara Miller. She is host of the Innovation Hub. Hey there, Kara.
Hey, this is an interesting thing because I think we tend to think that in the U.S. we have cornered the market on innovation, and we sort of fight amongst ourselves where are people going to be, obviously. Well, think about Mark Zuckerberg for a second. Obviously, he left this area, even though Facebook was really created, in a sense, in Cambridge.
We know that.
Right? He picked up and went to Silicon Valley. Now, there's some good reasons for that. One is there's a lot of people who created things there. But the other reason is there's a lot of software engineers there, right? So it's an easy place to pick people up.
But one thing that we see happening is that as we get more connected digitally, there are people in different parts of the world who just want to stay home. The other thing is, as we see it being tougher and tougher to get into the U.S., and this started with 9/11, but it really hasn't changed that much. It's very hard to get the visas that you need to get in. And you think about, you know, like, I mean, there would be no Apple if there were no Steve Jobs, and his father was a Syrian immigrant, right? You know, you think about Sergey Brin coming from Russia. So you have all these immigrants who've created things in America, and now I think more and more people are staying in the Middle East, in China, in other places.
So this is very bad for us.
Well, in some ways it's bad. I mean, it's, in other ways, Facebook doesn't stop at the borders of the U.S., so something that was created in California can benefit people all over the world. And one of the fascinating things I've seen is the Middle East is becoming a place where there's a tremendous amount of innovation, which is like so contrary to the narrative that we hear about the Middle East.
Well, before you continue with that, though, when I read about this morning, what I always would hear from business leaders in my former lives is, we don't care about X, Y, or Z. What we care most about is stability. Even if we're not crazy about a particular environment, even if we don't like the tax structure, even we want to know that there's stability so we know what the playing field is. What place is less stable than the Middle East that they're willing to invest and expand in? Is that how do they deal with that?
I'll tell you some things the Middle East has going for it. Clearly, stability is not one of those things, but they've got an incredibly young population. Egypt, which we've heard so much negative things about, has 115% cell phone penetration, which means 15% of the population's got more than one cell phone, right?
Is that true?
Yes. And the average income is about $6,000. So even with very little money, people are getting cell phones. And one of the things about our technology is it allows you to know what's happening in other parts of the world. And young people in the Middle East want to be a part of this. I mean, even though things in Egypt went so horribly wrong, it, don't forget, it was a Google activist, a guy working at Google, right? Wael Ghanim, who was like, let's organize. He organized things on Facebook, used Google. And I mean, I think you've got a whole generation of young people saying, we don't like what the government's doing. We can find ways to hack our way around it. And there's some awfully impressive things coming out of the Middle East.
So is this theoretical or is this actually happening? Are people expanding in places like the Middle East or they're talking about expanding in the
Middle East? No. So already Yahoo has spent $200 million to buy a portal, an all-Arabic portal in the Middle East. PayPal is investing. They see this as real potential. And you actually saw there was a show called Stars of Science in 2012, 2013, which is basically, we have American Idol for singing. This was their American Idol for who can come up with the best invention in the Middle East.
That is great.
Yes.
What's it called? Stars of Science. That is great.
And this woman came in, I think she came in third place ultimately, but she was in the top five when they were narrowing it down. There was one woman in the top five. She was a swimmer at the University of Beirut. And you know how, like, when you're done swimming, you can test what your pulse is and, like, how, you know, what your blood pressure is, how well you've been doing. And she was like, well, that's okay, but I'd like to know while I'm swimming. So she created this like Google Glass thing in your goggles so that while you're swimming, it will be blue in your goggles if you're in like the fat burning zone, and it will be green if you're in, I think it's the optimal performance zone, and it will be red. So you don't have to check your wrist. I mean, when you're swimming, it's very inconvenient to check your wrist or to do something after you're done. So she created these things. She gets into the top five of this Stars of Science, and some of the men in the top five would not speak to her because they thought it was like demeaning to talk to a woman. And she eventually came in third, created her own company called Instabeat, and it's making the goggles now.
So what did the guy who came in fourth and fifth do then with it? Did he change his mind about it being too demeaning for her? Isn't that terrible?
I know. But isn't that interesting? And it turns out a lot of these people in the Middle East who are, I think it's about a third of the entrepreneurs in the Middle East are women.
Fantastic.
So is this this is not, when you say the Middle East, we're not talking about one country in particular.
No.
We're talking about cross-border lines. So is John Kerry, our Secretary of State, a local guy, is stepping up his efforts to bring peace to the Middle East. Is the thesis about this that this has potential to help on that front as well as on the innovation front?
Well, I mean, I think I think what you've got is a little bit of a generational divide. I think you've got older people who are leading countries who are very, very entrenched in the sort of nationality thing. And younger people, I don't say they don't identify nationally, but I think you've got younger people who really do see themselves as citizens of the world, who are on Facebook just like we're on Facebook, who Google things just like we Google things,
right?
Who want to be on LinkedIn just like we're on LinkedIn. So in some ways, a lot of these companies break down barriers because everybody plays Candy Crush and is addicted to it. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, they start to break those down. And so there's a kind of language that exists amongst people who are involved on the web that way. And I think you have young people saying, look, people in other places are doing – I'm downloading apps that were made in Silicon Valley. I can make an app too. And that's the interesting thing. It used to be people in Silicon Valley had access that other people didn't. Now you've got 7 billion people in the world. In a few years, we're going to have 5 billion cell phones. That's 5 billion people who are going to be like, I could make an app.
So you often hear in the arguments about immigration reform that one of the things that we're losing is a lot of kids that come to school here. They go to MIT or they go to Harvard or Stanford or wherever it is. And because they can't get their visas, they end up going back to their native countries. And there was one guy that made the equivalent of Google. I guess it was an Indian. He went back to India. He wanted to stay here. I mean, I'm just thinking selfishly as an American about the jobs, because needless to say, the economy is not going that well. I mean, you're right. Facebook, everybody's on Facebook. It's all over the world. But selfishly, I'd like to keep more of these people that come to school here. I'd like to keep them here.
Well, I think that is tough. It certainly used to be that Silicon Valley used to be able to go all over the world, take the geniuses and say, you come hang out with us. And because of that, we have a lot of the companies that we've got today. And that's changing. I remember a conversation I had, it must have been a year or two ago, with one of the deans at the Fletcher School at Tufts, Bhaskar Chakravarti. And he said when he interviewed originally to come into this country, the immigration person said, you know, I know you're coming in and like you're going to go to graduate school, but you're going to go back, right? And he was like, oh, yeah, we've got cows and, you know, I mean, he had to explain that he had things to go back to. He totally wasn't planning to go back. But there's just such this antiquated, incredibly long process. And certainly, I mean, people like Tom Friedman have said, I wish that when people got PhDs, they got them stapled to their green cards.
Yeah.
And I've spent a lot of time at MIT. You go into those labs, chemistry labs, chemical engineering labs, you know, biology labs, whatever. It's like the United Nations. I mean, there are Germans and there are Spanish people and there are people from Japan and there are lots of people from China. And some people stay, but it is very, very hard. I have a friend who got his PhD at MIT, works at DuPont now. But it is a very tough road. And DuPont, who sponsors him, only gets a certain number of visas, you know, to keep people like him in the country. And it's every single year there is a dogfight between like the Microsofts and the Googles and the DuPonts because everybody wants some of those visas.
And I wonder of those kids, I mean, obviously you haven't done a, you know, Gallup poll, but what is your sense? Do some of those kids want to stay, but they can't stay, or good numbers of them want to stay?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah,
I think that's definitely true. But increasingly, you also see a lot more opportunity in like
their home.
China. Exactly. Yeah. So it used to be that people really were desperate to stay. Now they try, but a lot's going on in Shanghai too,
yeah.
And you can get rich in Shanghai too. So if they can't stay here, they will find an alternative. And you know, I talked to Chris Schroeder, an entrepreneur who's worked a lot in the Middle East, and he says he sees a lot of people who are super smart and they want to stay home. They don't want to come to Silicon Valley or Boston or New York.
So fast forward, we only have a minute left. 10 years from now, do a little Nostradamus thing. Where are the Silicon Valleys of the world? Is Silicon Valley still Silicon Valley, or is it going to be in the Middle East and China and India? What's the future look like?
I think Silicon Valley will still be Silicon Valley, but there are places like Singapore, like China, like Japan that are pouring a ton of money into creating miniature Silicon Valleys. And that, you know, I told you about that girl who won the Instabeat thing with the Google Glass goggles.
Yeah.
She won the MIT Middle East competition for a business plan. So it's not just people that it's not just random people going to the Middle East. It's also the MITs, the Harvards. They know that there's a lot of opportunity there, too. They have a presence there, too.
I love this. What was it called one more time? Stars of Science? Was it called?
Stars of Science.
How would that do in the United States? I'm serious.
I don't think it could compete with American Idol.
Not a chance.
We have to hope that Silicon Valley, which is not far from the San Andreas Fault, does not sink into the Pacific, because it'll be all over. There are some advantages, right? It's a beautiful place to live out there in Northern California.
Yes.
So we have to keep our fingers crossed for that, or it's all over, Jim.
So what's tonight and Saturday morning?
So you can hear more about this story tonight, and you can also hear our interview with Jack Andreka, who is the 15-year-old who won the Intel Science competition. Really interesting kid. Been profiled on 60 Minutes. Fascinating guy. And then this Saturday, we're talking to Kevin Kelly, who co-founded the magazine Wired, and he tells us why it's a good thing that robots will take all our jobs. So get ready.
That's great. Okay.
And why we're going to be dating robots.
Including journalists. So get ready.
Why should we exclude them?
Okay.
Kara, thanks. Great to see you.
Yeah, Kara, as Jim just said, she's on tonight at 9, Saturdays at 10. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, Tale of Two Cities. Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone challenges Salem's Mayor Kim Driscoll over the week's news. And Dan Shaughnessy on the Patriots. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Our show's a production of WGBH. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.